Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Here's the podcast for Live the Promise. Enjoy the conversation. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So glad you tuned in, and a very happy Friday to you. Well, here's a question for you. Have you ever been a time in your life where you look like you're all that on the outside, like things are going well, and you're very, you're great success, you got your health, you got your bank account, but maybe on the inside, you're imploding, you're dying on the inside, things aren't as they appear? Or maybe you're not there, but you're in a place where you've made some choices that hit you in a dead end, landed you in a dead end, and you wonder, is there any way out? Is there any way God can make sense of the mess that I've made? Well, both of those scenarios apply to our guest today at different points in his story. I can't wait for you to hear from him. Dr. Thomas Blee joins me, and the title of his book is How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. We're going to get him on in just a minute. A couple quick announcements for you. First, we're giving away one Bible every single week this month, and this Bible that we're giving away is the Financial Stewardship Bible. If you long to learn more about what God's Word says about finances, about faith, about stewardship, all you got to do is sign up. So hop on our website, MyFaithRadio.com, and you can win. Also, if you're traveling this season, I'd love for you to take us with you. We've got an amazing free app. Go to the Apple App Store or to Google Play. Search Faith Radio Network, and you'll find it. And this way, you can listen live to our programs or catch podcasts after the fact. It's an amazing app. We've got thousands of people listening from around the world since they discovered that app. Hope you can grab that, too. Get it on your phone and take us with you if you're traveling. All right, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. Dr. Thomas Blee is a proud father of two sons, Nick and Jack. He was born and raised in Rochester, Minnesota, to the son of a businessman and a tavern owner. He completed medical school at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and a general surgery residency at Gunderson Lutheran Medical Center in La Crosse. And for 12 years, he practiced general surgery in the small community setting of Red Wing, Minnesota. In 2014, he transitioned his practice to inner city trauma. And boy, does he have a story. We're so glad to have him with us. Dr. Blee, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to the conversation. So as you know, you listen. He tells me he listens to the show on his drive home from work. We love to start out talking scripture, and I'm wondering if you either have a life verse or just a verse you've been thinking about these days you can share with us.
I do. Actually, Matthew chapter 14, that was the one that changed my life. And there's a story behind it, because Jesus is in this town being Jesus, and he's healing and he's fixing and he's tired. He's with these 12 guys that he's walking around trying to teach this to, and he gets to the point where he says, I need a break. I need some strength. I need to go talk to my father. And he sends them on a boat to get to the other side of the lake. And lo and behold, a storm breaks out. And his boys are in peril. It's at that point where he has to do something completely impossible. He has to walk to get them. He has to walk across the water. And as he's doing that, Peter, in only the way that Peter can, recognizes this Jesus. And he knows he's in trouble. And in verse 30 and 31 is where Peter says, that's Jesus. I think that's Jesus. We need his help. And he calls his name, and Jesus says, it's me. And he says, if it's really you, then call. And he says, come get me. And Peter jumps out of the boat, which is, again, impossible. But as he's walking and as he's focusing on Christ, he's fine. But the minute he turns his eyes, he's sinking.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, there was a point in my life where I was sinking, and Jesus comes up and just grabs his hand, and he says, I have you. You know, oh, you have little faith. Don't worry, I'm here. I have you. I have this. I've got this. And they get back in the boat, and the storm settles. So when I started my faith walk and trying to figure out who Jesus was and started with Matthew and learning who Jesus was, that was the point where I thought, you know what? I've got help. So he's just grabbing my hand. No questions asked. If I stay focused on him, these storms won't get me.
Boy, good word. I'm telling you, somebody needed to hear that today. Fantastic. Give us a little backstory, if you would, on just your growing up years, what life was like for you when you knew you wanted to be a doctor.
Yeah. I grew up in in a town, modest-sized town, Rochester, Minnesota, south of the metro area here. My dad was a hard worker, businessman, and owned a bar. So I say I grew up in a bar. Mm. I learned different things growing up because it was almost a biker bar. So I sat on a bar stool, and I learned what conflict resolution was. I learned how things were settled.
Yes, literally.
But I also saw my dad, who was a very gentle man, never said a bad word about anyone, but worked very hard. At home was raging alcoholism.
Wow.
I tell these stories because I wouldn't trade my childhood for the world. And my mom and dad are both healthy now. Age 65, my mom finally got into recovery. But home was chaos. I'm the middle child of three, and my relief was just to run away and hide. We all had our own rooms, which was great. And then in my hiding and in my silence, I just read. And that's probably where the path started. You know, if my grades were good, nobody was touching me at home. The argument didn't come towards me. I wasn't it, so to speak. And so it was just chaos, chaos, chaos. I knew I didn't want to work as hard as my dad in business. And I had a grandmother who was a nurse. And at second grade, I thought, I like this idea of medicine. It was put on my heart.
Say at second grade, you said, I like this idea of medicine? Who thinks like that except a future doctor?
Right. There's a note I believe my mother still has in second grade. It said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I want to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. I want to know what it feels like to heal somebody.
Wow.
I don't know where that came from.
Amazing.
But, yeah, that's where it started.
Mm. Wow. And the idea that your escape was reading, which is actually just great for your brain and really in your formation and your capacity to learn. I mean, you look at how God kind of, you know, put desires in your heart even then to just fulfill the call of God on your life.
Right.
Okay, so then you become a doctor, a surgeon. Take us to that point in your story, because in the back cover of your book, you talk about, you know, it looks like you have it all. I mean, you're a surgeon, successful, and yet, as you say, you were imploding on the inside. Take us to that point of the story.
Right. The pressures I put on myself to succeed were my own pressures. You know, the grades were always good and so on. And I spent my time in college, I spent my time in medical school worrying about things that weren't successful, grades weren't there and so on. And there was always uneasy. There was always a clanging noise in my head. There was always this uneasiness. And I was always still being pulled back to the family with alcoholism and so on. I thought each time I would hit the next milestone, things would be better. You know, graduated with decent grades from college, got into medical school, was doing a lot of research, was doing things that people weren't supposed to do. At age 18, I was probably one of the youngest people in the United States to do a heart valve. I was in a research lab, and I was doing all of these things, traveling as a traveling surgeon at 20, 21.
Unbelievable.
Right. And,
wow.
But empty.
Mm.
And into residency, and so on. So, you know, on the outside, it was great. But on the inside, it wasn't satisfied. And as I moved more in my medical career, complications really would hit me hard. You know, what did I do wrong? How can this be happening? I'm doing everything right. And I would just stay awake at that night, mulling over situations. And I always say that I was probably one of the better surgeons you were going to have, because I was constantly thinking, constantly trying to do better, constantly trying to work through these situations. But it's not sustainable.
Hmm. This is just a side note, but I got to say this, you know, in this entitled culture that we live in, it's, you know, doctors are still human. And I can only imagine the pressure you put on people, because we expect a perfect result. And if we're entitled to a perfect result, and if we don't get it, we're suing you. I mean, that to me is so heart-wrenching, because it's like, at what point can we, you know, open our hands a little bit and entrust this story, the bigger story, to God? And even if you're not a person of faith, to have enough sense to say, things are going to happen sometimes. Everybody's not going to get it right all the time. And can this be okay, you know?
Right, exactly. And I think to that point, the revival we're seeing in medicine is that we know we need help.
Mm.
And it's been amazing. You know, if you go to the end of the story and what the book has been doing, I'm seeing these pockets pop up in all these hospitals and faith coming back and saying, you know, we're not perfect and we need help.
Wow.
But it's a tough place to live in, mm-hmm. when all of that weight is on your shoulders. And for me, it was silence. It put me into silence.
So would you say what you were feeling at that point as a successful surgeon, because you're getting a lot of things right, but you're dealing with life-death choices constantly, and things maybe aren't so great at home for you right now at this
right.
point. How would you, if you were to give a few words to what the internal battle looked like, what it felt like, what would they be?
there's two things. There's this clanging noise, and I write about it in my book. It's just, it doesn't matter if I was quiet, I couldn't relax. There was this buzzing, there was this tug, there was this, what are you doing? You know, you wouldn't be relaxing. You should be doing something to improve this care and something, or take care of your family. And I didn't have the energy to turn to the family in ways. And it's the heaviness. It's just this, I've done everything right, and I just don't feel better. You know, and I don't think my patients took it that way. You know, I had great rapport with my patients and amazing families that still write me letters and so on, but it was just never good enough.
And when you had this sense of misery, you'd call your sister.
I did,
yeah. And what would she say?
Well, my sister came later in part of this when things were really kind of falling apart and the confusion was getting more unbearable. She was on a walk of faith, and she's an amazing woman. She has a story that will stop you in her tracks. She became kind of reliable to me. She became, you know, we could work through certain situations and so on, but she never had the answer. I mean, she did get to know Jesus, but I never took it. You know, I don't need Jesus. And I think
I'm calling because I'm miserable, but that's not the answer that I want.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm a scientist. I can work through this. I can read more. I can figure this out. You know, there's a formula that I haven't discovered yet to fix this.
We're going to pause here. When we come back, there's parts of Dr. Blee's story that are going to absolutely amaze you. But when we come back, let's talk about just when you did finally give Jesus 15 minutes of your time. You gave him 15 minutes to show himself strong on your behalf. Talking to Dr. Thomas Blee, title of his book, How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. We're going to talk about just the idea of healing and what the Word says, what we can have, what we can expect from God. I'm just curious to process your perspective on faith and healing and medicine and all those things. Lots of great story up ahead, but I want you to get a copy of this book. We've got about 5 copies, so email me if you want in on the drawing, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget your mailing address, and we will be back in a minute. Really glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Of the Promise, talking to Dr. Thomas Blee, author of the book, How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. Boy, you're not going to want to put this book down. We've got 5 copies. Why don't you email me if you want in on the drawing, Susie@myfaithradio.com. So before the break, Doc, we were talking about your backstory, just your growing up years and hardworking parents, but not faith really to speak of. Now you're a successful surgeon, but you're miserable on the inside. Things aren't on the inside as they should be, so to speak, and you call your sister. She's like, I've told you before, I'll tell you again. The answer is Jesus. Well, you finally decide to give Jesus a shot. And if I remember right, you kneel down or you're in your room and you basically give him 15 minutes.
Right.
Let's talk about that.
I gave him 5 minutes.
5 minutes,
actually,
okay.
You know, and I think that's what's remarkable, because when you really are reaching for Jesus, he comes to you as who you are. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, I'm programmed as a surgeon. I'm programmed to make decisions. And I had made a transition in my practice from slower paced community general surgery to trauma surgery. So I was even more desperate for this solution. And I was just out of gas. I was tired. I was worn out. My marriage, there was a line in the sand where that was over. And I didn't know what to do. So I called my sister and started with the same conversation she had heard many times. And she just let me vent. I was in tears before I could even talk to her. And there was just silence. And she said, you know, Tom, you just need to get to know Jesus. And that was it. We hung up. And I sat in this dark room, it was probably 10:30 at night, and there was just nobody in the house. And I just said, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. And I don't even know what to do. I prayed. I didn't even know how to pray. I thought, you know, I should probably get on my knees. And I literally got on my knees, and I said, okay, I got nothing left. I'm tapped out, and I'm going to tap out. So you literally have about 5 minutes to show me. And he did. I stood up and instantly felt different.
Wow.
Instantly. That clanging noise, that buzzing silence was just kind of gone. And there was a presence. You know, it was Matthew chapter 14. You know, he reached out and grabbed me.
It's also Psalm 18, you know. The enemy confronts you in your day of disaster. And, it, you know, he's too strong for you, but the Lord reaches down from on high and lifts you up, right? And lifts you high above your enemy.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And from there, and this is part of the humorous part, because when you live in a small town and your life is radically changed and you don't know what to do, you head to Walmart.
Of course.
That's the only thing that was open. And I don't know why. I drove to Walmart. I drove to Walmart 11:30 at night. This is March 1st, 2014, so it's near Easter season. I walked into that building, and I'm not kidding you, there's Bibles on sale. And when I walked in, I'm looking at the Bibles, and they're in big print. And my eyes, there's a big joke, my eyes are getting terrible. You don't want to hear that from a surgeon, but okay, I thought, okay, a Bible on sale, I'll give you that one. Big print, I'll give you that one too. And then I opened the book, and everything Jesus says is in red.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, it can't be any louder. So I bought one.
Wow, right? I love it.
I went home that night, probably 11:30 and so on. I said, well, I got to figure this guy out. I'll start from page one in Matthew. And I just kept reading. Until chapter 14, until I hit that part where he reaches down and grabs Peter, and I just stopped. And I said, okay, hope. Something's happening. And as a scientist, you know, we're trained. When you find something that works, when you assimilate it into your practice, then you know you're okay. So I thought, okay, this makes sense. So let me use it as a surgeon. Let me start doing some of these things that people are saying. Let me collect some data. And then it got into me, and I like, no, this works. And it just kept going and going and going.
Wow.
Okay. And that's how he comes to you as you are. He needed to come to me as a surgeon, as a scientist, and he needed to be big and bold and thanks, Jesus.
Amen. That he loves you so much that he just knows how he made you, and he knows how you'll hear him. And so you start to hear him. Interesting, you wrote, Dr. Tom, that life actually, you know, you would have thought things would have fallen into place after that. But actually, the Lord allowed you to walk some of the most painful stretch of this journey after you came to Christ. So talk to us about that.
Right. Yeah, it was horrible.
Mm.
And I don't want to say that to discourage anyone, because it's horribly healing. It's unexplainable. But every day got worse and worse.
And how
worse.
So?
It just, you know, what I thought he was going to fix, he didn't. I thought he was going to zap this marriage problem and that would be done. I thought that job would get easier and it didn't. I just thought everything was going to come to fruition, but every aspect of my life was challenged in about two and a half years. From finances to friends to this divorce to the hospital, where everything. But coming through the storm, I know that's what it had to be. And it's so much better. It's so refined. It was just clearing my vision.
And the lowest point came at when there was an altercation with some family members.
Right.
Can you take us to that point?
I can. There were some low points.
Are you okay with that?
I am. And you know what's interesting? I've never talked about this. And my sister was saying, you know, she's like, somebody's going to bring you to this and let's work through it. And you're the perfect person to do this, because there's still healing that needs to happen. So there were some accusations made. There was an altercation that happened. There was some premeditation on the other part. And when it was all over, I was in jail. Going to jail, I was saying, you guys know this isn't true. And I, you know, the police didn't care.
Wow.
They're like, you're done. And I just sat in that car and said, I got nothing right now but him. I mean, you talk about having to have faith. I couldn't believe it. And I really had to ride this out with my mouth closed and never been tested like that before.
Did you question God at that point? Or did you have enough of an experience with him that you were glad that you had him because you had nothing else?
I had enough of an experience. I knew he was there. I was comfortable in jail, but I was impatient.
How long were you in jail?
Overnight.
Okay. And this is so amazing. Is that you had a sense when you kind of quieted your soul that God actually had someone for you to talk to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that was as I was being booked into jail that night, and I just got to the point of saying, I can't say this is ridiculous anymore. And they were discussing about if I'm alone in a cell or if I have somebody, and the jailer says, you have a roommate. And I said, you know what? That's okay. I really think I'm supposed to talk to somebody.
That's amazing.
I had never taken my cross off my neck till that night, and he was putting it into an envelope. And he looked at me and said, what do you mean? And I said, it has something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of went, huh.
Like, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Then I was put into a room with a young man, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I, you know, this is foreign to me. Surgeons don't end up in here. And as I looked over at him, he's on his elbows, on his tummy, and he's looking at me. And I said, I'm sorry to wake you. He says, I haven't slept in days. And I introduced myself, and he knew me. You know,
wow.
Small town, he knew me. He knew me. It's in the book. You know, he says, oh, my best friend married your neighbor's daughter. And I'm like, wow, you can't get away from this.
Mm.
And he says, you're a surgeon. I said, yeah. He said, what are you going to do? I said, all I have right now is my faith. All I can do is pray. And as he unpacked, you know, you get this bin with all this stuff. I don't know what it is. He helps me settle in. And as we're sitting there, he says, you know, he says, can I ask you something? I said, yeah. And he said, what do you mean by faith? And I said, right now, all I can do is pray. He said, I am so lost right now. I have no faith. Can we talk?
Wow.
And I said, I got nothing but time, right? We talked for 2-3 hours. We talked about faith. I went through the Bible in an explanation that only I speak differently about the Bible. And we prayed. I said, we just need to pray. And I prayed for this young man, and in minutes he was sleeping, snoring.
Oh, man.
Then he was my buddy and I was his, and we moved through this process. I didn't have an attorney. I couldn't make phone calls. I'd gotten one phone call out to my sister before they grabbed my cell phone. I had no attorney set up. I had nothing. Woke up in the morning and it's like, oh, and I didn't even sleep. I mean, they open the doors, you know, you're locked in and all these things happen. And Andy's like, I got this. And we're trying to eat and we're doing things. And, he's like, I'll get you an attorney. I'll talk to mine. Then I still didn't know what was going to happen. I had gotten called from my cell about 10 in the morning. There was a good friend of mine who was on the sheriff's department who had pulled my file, came in and says, I know what's going on here. Don't worry about it. He got me an attorney. And in between all these events, I was ending up in the cell with Andy, who's in my book, and he lets me use his name because he's an amazing story. But he and I would just pray in between.
My goodness.
Then we kept doing it to the point of me, you know, the lowest of the low is I'm in shackles. I haven't showered for a day. I was a big mountain biker. I looked terrible. And I walk into court, and there's my sister.
Mm.
And there's my team. There's John Turnipseed, who's in my book, and there's people there. Amy had gotten an inkling, had Googled this phone number that showed up, found out it was in jail. She's like, I knew it was you, and they're in court. And they walked me through it. And that's what God does.
Wow.
Takes care of you.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just holding my breath. I want to hear how you got out and what God did after that. And God has restored his story and what God has done to use him to help facilitate healing in other people's lives and restoration is absolutely amazing. He speaks like the book reads. You want a copy of this book, email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Title of the book is How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. You know we serve a God of the impossible. Don't go away. More great conversation up ahead. Isn't that the cry of all of our hearts? If you love Jesus, you follow him, and you have the Spirit of the living God in you. Wherever you go, the mountains and the valleys, the storms and the fires, as we stay in that abiding place, people actually will see him and us. So glad you tuned in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Dr. Thomas Blee. What an amazing, wonderful man of God. Title of his book is How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. And if you just tuned in, oh my goodness, you got to go back and catch the podcast, catch his backstory, because we're kind of catching up here. But just in short, a successful surgeon, but still feeling empty on the inside, feeling like he's imploding on the inside. His sister suggests that he give Jesus a try. He gets on his knees. The Lord meets him. He becomes a Christian, and some of his hardest days are ahead for him, where his marriage falls apart. There was a family situation, an altercation that felt like a setup, and here this respected surgeon finds himself in jail. And so here you are. You don't have a cell phone. You don't have an attorney. But you're ministering most of the night to your cellmate, praying with him, telling him about the Lord, which is just so admirable and amazing to me. But you end up in court and you find your sister. She figures out where you are, and she gets a tribe of people to support you. Here we are at this point of the story. Take it from there.
Right. So I walked into court, and things went pretty quickly. There were certain things that were dropped. There were certain things, and basically they just said, you know, you've just got to get out of town. And I said the plan was already making. I was released from jail. I went with my sister. I had 20 minutes with a police officer to go to my house and to get everything I could in 20 minutes.
I mean, they literally meant you have to get out of town?
You have to, yeah, they just said you needed to go. And Amy said, you're coming to live with me. She lived in a different city. So we went and grabbed whatever I could.
Wow.
That was the last time I was ever in my house. Ever. And I moved from there to my sister's house and was with her for about 4 months. The next day I had to go to work, and I had to explain what had happened to them, and I was suspended. I have an amazing hospital that I work for, amazing people that know me, and they said, we know you, we know what's happening, you can appeal the suspension. I said, I appeal it, and I had to do some paperwork. Within 30 minutes, I was back to work, but they were with me. We were checking in every day, and it wasn't from a medical risk standpoint. It was, how are you doing? Can you function? I said, I need to. This is where God is always with me in the hospital. I said, I need to be here. So the suspension was lifted, but then I had to be reported to the board. So then there was a whole other process where I had to defend my medical license to the board. And that was coming down the road. So here I sit with no home. The last thing my son saw, my youngest son, Jack, who was at home, was a lot of words from a different person. And there was almost about 3 months before I could talk to him.
Mm. And how old was he at the time?
14.
Mm. Wow.
And so I had no children, you know, I didn't have a house. I was suspended. I'm fighting my medical license. I've got criminal charges pending. It's a mess.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, thank you. But I had my sister and her two kids. And that was the most amazing cleansing time to have when in trouble, seek wise counsel. I had one of the wisest counselors I could imagine. And every day we would work stuff. And I didn't know if I was going to come home in tears. I didn't know what an attorney letter was going to be. I mean, here's the divorce.
Everything's up in the air for
everything.
You.
I have no access to any money. She said, don't worry about it. I had nothing. I mean, I was borrowing money for gas from her. She was taking care of the food.
Were they not able to pay you at work?
They paid me, but it was in a joint account now being held because of a divorce.
Wow.
And I couldn't get into town to do anything. It wasn't, and there were aspects where it wasn't safe to me for me to be in town. I just didn't have access, and I didn't know what was going to happen. That was just another time of working through it. But you talk about not having anything else to do but strengthen your faith, because my time was just in discussion. I watched her read the Bible. I watched her pray. I watched her pray big, and I mimicked things, and I reached out. And that was also a time where it was like, you know, I can't be with my son, but God put a lot of kids in my life to be a father to them. That was my life team program. Mm-hmm. My gang intervention program really took off, and so on. So other things were there, but it was horrible. Absolutely. You know, horrible.
I don't know why this reminds me of when King David was utterly betrayed by a family member and is shoved out of town for a while, you know. But he was such a surrendered soul that he entrusted his reputation to God. He entrusted his promotion to God. And God does that in due time, you know. He restores.
Right.
Wow.
When I drove into town to move into my sister's house, you know, listening to this radio station, it was the story of Joseph. You know, being falsely accused, being imprisoned, being held down, and the time it takes to restoration. I had started with a men's group in Red Wing, an amazing group. They're actually the beer and banter group from a church. They meet and have a beer, right? Yeah. You know, Bible says drink, don't get drunk, you know. And here's this ragtag group that had surrounded me months before, and they were my connection back to my son. When my son turned 13, I said, I need 10 good men around him. And they had exchanged numbers. And I had practiced with him for months before this. Jack, what do you do if you can't get a hold of me? I have these numbers. And it had to be used. And so they were connecting with me. They were watching my son. They were doing these things. And But what's interesting is George, who started this group, called me that night and said, "You remind me of Joseph." I'm like, "I just heard that on the way in."
Hmm.
You know.
It's just something that's amazing about your story. It is such a testament of God's faithfulness because, you know, people will do what people do, you know, and life has a way of lifing us, so to speak. But there's always provision of peace, and there's always a provision of grace, and He is a God of righteousness and justice. So He sees exactly the dividing line. If something's been unjust, He sees it. And even though He lets us go through it, there's a provision there for you, right? And you're seeing His hand of provision, and it's still not the end of the story because He's still restoring you.
Right. And that's a tough... It's tough to be patient with that.
Yeah.
It's tough to trust that. And that's building of the faith and so on. And I don't know what the end of the story is because it's happening. I mean, there's a restart.
It's still really fresh for you, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And I'm still rebuilding relationships, even with my two sons. Mm-hmm. My eldest son, Nick's out of the house. There's a lot of raw spots.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you feel like... how do I want to phrase this? You know, when you think of what you've been through, what kind of man do you think you would have been had you not walked this really tough path?
It wouldn't have worked. Hmm. I don't know where. I would have either been committed for depression. You know, I never would have committed suicide or anything like that. That's just not me. But it would have been, an ugly divorce, separated from my sons. It would have been completely different. Hmm.
Now, talk about what you do for these gang members, for these young kids. Talk about your ministry and your heart.
Yeah, so... You know, March 1st, 2014, I'm on my knees and I'm trying to do something different. And it was just a few weeks later in the hospital. So I spent one season in Regions Hospital in inner city St. Paul watching something I had never seen. I'm a small town surgeon. I come up here and the shootings that make the news are 1/10 of what we see.
Hmm.
And to see these kids so beaten down, so broken down, and the noise that follows them, and you listen to them plan retaliations and you watch what happens to them. And I made it through the trauma season, Memorial Day to Labor Day. It's just awful.
Really? Wow.
And we're hitting that now.
Hmm.
And I just said, this isn't right. You know, the line I always use is in Red Wing, if someone knocks on your door, you get cookies. Why am I getting cookies? Because I mowed your lawn. And I'm watching kids who open the door and they get, you know, 5 rounds from a 9mm into their chest. So after coming to Christ, after figuring out, he threw a situation at me at the hospital. We had two young men involved in two separate gangs and in the hospital, and it shut down one floor, just a hallway of my hospital. And this nurse came up to me and said, "You need to go fix this." And I said, "Why me?" And she said, "You're standing here." And I thought, okay, I'd listened to some stuff about following prompts and literally. And so I went down the hall and tried to talk to these groups of people.
They were having a standoff? Is that what you're saying?
No, it was just there's so much. These kids are so beaten down that the noise that followed, it's big families. It's all kinds of stuff. And you can't connect with them. And they're quiet. They don't move. Their sheets are at the nose. The room is always dark. It's very dark.
Hmm.
And it fell on my face. And when I left work that day, I called my sister and said, "I think I'm supposed to do something with this, and I don't know what." And she said, "Well, just pray about it." And 2 days later, she calls and said, "You need to talk to this man, John Turnipseed." Heard his interview on this radio station.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. You know, and his history is the worst gangbanger in the history of Minnesota. You know, 30 family members in prison for murder, 300 for other crimes. He's been shot at 10 times, crack dealer, pimp, everything. In the 90s, Minneapolis is Murderapolis. That's John and his family. But 20 years ago, he turned it around. And now South Minneapolis and Urban Ventures is one of the safest places to be. So I listened to it. I backdoored a way to get a hold of him. And we met for lunch in Minneapolis. Told him this very same story. I said, "John, I need you in my hospital to work with these kids. And let's call it Life Team. We have two teams at the hospital for end of life in hospice and in palliative care." I said, "We need one for life."
Hmm.
And it was that's how we made this concept. And we started working with kids. And the first young man we grabbed is in my book, Keontae, an amazing story. Kid should be dead. Should have been dead 2 or 3 times over. So that ministry is so big you can't expand because now I have a coalition. I meet every other month. I work with the St. Paul gang unit. I have 5 different organizations that are in my building. I have a Latino interventional specialist team, Asian, African-American, I have women, you know, for young women and stuff. I have Neighborhood House, Ujamaa Place, all these organizations that come in and say, "We're going to take these kids." There's not a problem they can throw at us that we don't have a solution to.
Unbelievable.
Yep. Not a
single
one.
Amazing. And was the rest of your team at the hospital open to you just saying, we're doing this?
The nurses were, you know, and Catherine is with me today as one of my nurses. You know, they saw changes. It took some time. I came in as a grassroots. We're still working through some stuff, but they're wrapping their arms around it.
And, you know, Jesus says things are proven right by their fruit. And when things start to bear fruit, the proof is in the pudding, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is. And it's expanded. Here's what's interesting is I've spent no money on this program. Zero. These organizations have funding. They come in and they do it. But if you see a shooting on the news, we activate a team that shuts down that city. I have 30 community ambassadors that go out. And there's a constant information gathering. Keeps my hospital safe. It keeps my patients safe. It keeps everything is moving. You know, and what these officers do is amazing. Absolutely amazing. And we get to the point where now with that 10 group, the 10 men in Red Wing, even if there's a young man accused of shooting who's in jail under 18, he's in Red Wing, in the Red Wing prison. I have 10 guys in that prison. We build planter boxes with these kids. We teach them to give something. A month ago, two guys were released. We took these two kids with the 10 guys, went back to their neighborhood to hand out these planter boxes, and that's restitution for those guys. That's nothing, and that's how big this has gotten.
I'm just undone. I mean, one night in prison, yeah. You get to be with someone in your cell and to have a heart. I mean, you know, you think about, you know, in a successful surgeon. I mean, you would ride on a 30,000-foot view socially, I would think, right? I mean, you're in the dredges of dealing with the crisis of humanity, but I think a lot of surgeons then, you know, like to live and see things from the 30,000-foot view. But, you know, what God has done and where he's brought you in that night in prison, and you look at what I'm just overwhelmed by it. I mean, it's amazing.
It's bigger than us. You can't make it up.
No, you sure can't.
Right.
Wow. Okay. We need to take a break. And doctor says I have allergy voice. That's what Dr. Bleak told me during the break. So it's the season. When we come back, I'd love for you to tell about Caitlin and yeah. And talk about just your concept and thoughts on healing. If you listen often enough, I know you say you do. You know, coming through some health stuff myself, I've just been wrapping my arms around what God's Word says about healing, because there's some really strong opinions from different camps in the Christian faith. And I would just love to process that a little bit with you. So,
absolutely.
As somebody whom God is using to bring healing on many levels. Talking to Dr. Thomas Blee, title of his book, How to Save a Surgeon. As I said, he talks like this book reads. Email me. Aaron tells me we probably even maybe have more than 5 copies, so you should email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget your mailing address. We'll be back in a minute. Plan for you. He's got his hand on you. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Dr. Thomas Blee, author of the book How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. And oh my goodness, if you just tuned in, I want you to go back, catch the whole podcast. This story is absolutely amazing, but we've got to pick it up from here. I want you to tell us Caitlin's story. In fact, what you do in the book is you kind of weave in a number of stories of people who've encountered trauma, and some who live and some who die. But talk to us about Caitlin's story.
Right. So as I got to know Jesus and God, one thing he said to me is, I'm here with you. And he did it in very explosive ways in something I could understand, which was the hospital. And so Caitlin was an interesting story because it was just a few months after I found Jesus. So when we're working our trauma system, there's a phone on our hip and it connects us to the world. And I got a transfer call from a different hospital. And it was about a young woman who was leaving high school and was hit by a dump truck. Mm-hmm. Driver's side door and so on. And this doc who did an amazing job said, I've done everything I can. She has a breathing tube in. She has a chest tube in. I got a binder in her pelvis. You've got all the blood this hospital has, and she's coming to you. And it was a horrible day, rainy and everything. We couldn't fly. And I hung up the phone and I thought, wow, what's going to happen? Now, the difference in my life at that point is, though, I was praying. I prayed when I hung up that phone, and I had my physician's assistant, Jose, who was another man of faith given to me at the hospital. We prayed. And when we hit the trauma bay, the report was no blood pressure, 60 over nothing, which is incompatible with life. You start CPR at that. And she rolled in, and there's a chair I sit in, and I pray, and I get this report, and I'm like, okay, this is a less than 0.5% chance of survival. Blunt cardiac injury, it doesn't work. And my other half of my team, my ER team, said, we should probably just call this. And Jose was like, she's not dead. And she didn't look dead. And I was praying. I said, give me the wisdom. What are we going to do? And something just said, get going, start CPR. Mm. You know, we slap a machine on her that we had never used in blunt cardiac injury. It's been used in heart attacks. We put a CPR machine on her. She has no veins. We're drilling into her shins. And we have coolers of blood, and we're just putting blood in as fast as we can. We're running to the operating room. My anesthesiologist looked at me and said, what are you doing? I said, just go with this. He says, it's blunt trauma. I said, just go. He said, absolutely. And in we went. They're putting lines in her neck. They're doing everything they can. I'm throwing on what I can surgically, and I'm in there with this machine going, and I open up her belly, you know, and there's blood splashing all over the place. It's running off the table, and I'm like, I just got to get upstream, and I reached up to her diaphragm, and I pushed her aorta against her spine. Her spleen is a mess. I'm holding that. My residents are packing her pelvis. I mean, there's shards of bone sticking out, and you just sit, and we're trying to catch up and fill her tank. And what's interesting is Caitlin and I were just at the Minnesota prayer breakfast presenting her, because that's where I was March 1st. My tank was empty. And there was a point where I just sit and I said, fill my tank. And I sat in prayer. We stopped the CPR machine and my hand is up against her diaphragm and I'm like, okay, we got a heartbeat, guys. And then it starts really going. And then it's spleen in the bucket. You know, we put a cage on her pelvis to X-fix her. We temporarily pack her. We throw her in the SICU. And then it's a matter of, okay, what else is wrong with this young woman? Because the force was horrible. The importance of her story, though, was when I left that operating room, a nurse hands me a cup, and then the cup is a cross. And I thought, that's interesting. And I walked to speak to her family, and it's a horrible walk in these situations. But I had Jesus with me.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped in the locker room. You have to change your clothes. You got to get new pants. You throw your socks in the garbage because they're all bloody. You wring your shoes out in the sink. You just inspect yourself to make sure that you're not bringing.
Wow. I never even thought of that.
Oh, yeah. You can have body parts on you that you don't even know that,
wow.
You know.
Wow.
And I walked down that hallway not even knowing what to say, but at least praying. And there's her father, Troy, and her grandmother, Marlene, who become dear friends. And all I could do was blurt out, she's alive. And they were in tears and on it went. And they prayed. I hadn't prayed a lot out loud. They prayed. But I do remember, when I say this in my book, I shook his hand. And I'm like, do you know where that hand was? It was just holding your daughter's aorta. And I left thinking, she's going to be okay. But we had no idea. Most of these situations, the bowel goes down, the liver shuts down, kidneys shut down, there's head bleeds and so on.
Let's just say this again. A dump truck T-boned her on the driver's
55
side.
55 miles an hour. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And to shorten it, I mean, she had some bleeding in her head. She had some other stuff. One of my partners took her back to the operating room 2 days later to close her belly back up, and things looked amazing. And you never see that. Usually they're so swollen you can't get people closed, and it's a whole process, and it was pristine. And the orthopedic team had stabilized her pelvis, and we were to the point where we were going to wake her up. And it took a couple days, but I was on vacation. I came back, and I said, how's it going? And her grandma said, she's not waking up. And I literally went up to Caitlin's ear, and I shouted, and I said, wake up. And she kind of fluttered and opened her eyes, and grandma pushed me out of the way and started talking to her.
I got this now.
I'm second fiddle.
Yeah.
And started talking to her, and Caitlin woke up. And Caitlin looks down, you know, and can see this cage sticking out from the sheets that's holding her pelvis together. And she says, Grandma, they turned me into a boy. And Grandma says, that's Caitlin. That's her sense of humor.
Wow.
She's completely fine.
Wow.
And out of the surgical ICU, and a few days later, discharged, bypassed rehab, made it home in a wheelchair, and actually graduated from high school 3 weeks later wearing a T-shirt that said, I'm tougher than a dump truck.
Hey. Amazing. Amazing. And this is why, you know, Kevin and I pray daily for our first responders. We pray for our military, our police, our trauma, you know, docs and all of those, because you guys are on the front lines. You really, really are on the front lines of the war of humanity. And man, if there are people of faith there, I mean, if someone would have called it, that would have been it. But faith came, you know, and
right.
Faith is a substance of things hoped for, and it's the evidence of things not seen. And now she, can she walk okay? How is she now?
She just had a baby 3 months ago.
Oh, my goodness.
At the prayer breakfast, we told Caitlin's story, and she walked up and with Delilah, her child.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unbelievable. I got to quit saying that word, unbelievable. Yeah. We've got a couple minutes before it's time to wrap, but just give me a vision for what's God saying to you these days? Where do you want to go? What do you sense he wants to do in and through? I mean, what he's doing now is amazing to me, but any sense of future landscape?
Yeah, Life Team, the program itself is expanding. We're opening, we have a program started in Duluth. My PA, Jose, is in Duluth. We've just been working with clients up there. I want it in hospital. St. Cloud, hopefully, is next. So in the metropolitan area of Minnesota, we're bopping into hospitals, and I think it's a framework that should be replicated. I've had two presentations to national healthcare policy about it. So that's it. In my own small town, I want my headquarters. I want a fathering center. I want the opportunity for restoration. Generational change is very tough, and that's what's happening with the inner city, but it's all over. Pain is pain. People will invite me to speak and say, don't talk about gang stuff. Talk about healing. And it's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a divorce, if it's in jail, if it's the inner city gang stuff. Pain is pain. Mm-hmm. That's what the message needs to be. You can get impossible healing when you invite Christ in. It doesn't matter how you label it. He knows. He's been through all of it. All of it. So that's kind of where I'm going.
Boy, that's amazing. And forgot to ask you about just the idea, the thoughts on healing. So you're going to have to come back because I really want you to come in with your other buddy and hear more about the ministry. But I think we probably both agree that, I mean, God is the God of the impossible. He still does perform miracles today, but there's still a mystery involved. And there are some people who are healed on the other side. And so what do? We err on the side of faith and we keep believing and praying and trusting and then trust the ultimate story to him, right?
Absolutely. Mm. And don't be limited on the healing of what you think it is.
Exactly.
You know, he'll bring you across the finish line in whatever way, shape, or form he needs to. And no matter how tragic some of these events are in the trauma bay, I tell my residents, run to them, be with them, because you will see families reunited around this person. That person's going to be fine. They're going to be healed in heaven.
Wow, good point. Yeah. But the crisis in itself could reunite the family.
It does, and a nurse reengages a different way. Somebody sees something happening, and what's happening even in my own hospital is faith is coming. There's a prayer group in my ER now, up to 40 people.
My goodness.
And people are talking about it and so on. So healing, it is. It's just...
And it comes in different shapes and sizes, doesn't it? Yeah.
But expect it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, I feel like we just scratched the surface. I really do pray you'll come back and join
us,
Doc. But as we wrap, I'm just thinking there's somebody listening today. We've got as many men listening as women. And I feel like it's a guy. And I feel like he's made choices that he's landed himself in a very bad dead end. Would you pray for him?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Heavenly Father, I pray that you make this healing open to the just make it palpable. Mm-hmm. Anyone that's listening, just make it palpable and know that they can come to you in their own terms, in their own language, in a very simple way, and that you've got them. You will reach down, you will grab them, and you've got them.
Yeah.
And I pray for that, to remove any doubt from anyone that's listening right now. Doubt their doubt. Don't doubt their faith. And I give thanks for everything that you've done and for letting me be an example of that today.
Thank you, Jesus.
In Jesus' name.
Dr. Blee, thank you for how you've stewarded your story and for joining us today. Really, truly a great honor.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. In just a bit, you'll find a podcast of today's program up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Love for you to enter the drawing for this book. I want you to have a copy. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. And the title is How to Save a Surgeon. And remember this, the Lord wants you to last long and finish strong, and he is the one who'll keep you strong to the end. Have a great day. For listening to this conversation from Live the Promise. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend. Help grow the impact of the show. Also, if you would, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player, and then never miss a show.